Labyrinths is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. Please consider becoming a patron. For as little as $5 a month, you can listen to Labyrinths ad-free.
Visit patreon.com/KnoxRobinson to learn more.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Right after I left Westboro Baptist Church, I think there's no question in my mind that that was the time that I felt most lost, because in the absence of the ideology in which I was raised and the community in which I was raised and the structure and rules in which I was raised, it suddenly felt like everything in my life was in flux. I had a sense of myself all my years, like this, I was engaged in this, you know, the work of God. This is the one way for me to be good and to do good in the world. And my sense of myself as, at the church, we definitely wouldn't have called ourselves good people. But again, the sense that I was doing good, like everything was just, it felt completely backwards and upside down and crushing. Just the reality of now being in the world and not having any idea. I don't have a purpose. I don't have a plan. I don't know where I'm going or why or how to get there. And so it's just this crushing existential dread, essentially, all at once. And it was terrifying.
Feeling lost?
Then you're in the right place.
I'm Amanda Knox.
And I'm Christopher Robinson.
And this is Labyrinths.
Today's guest is Megan Phelps Roper. She is the author of the book Unfollow, A Journey from Hatred to Hope, and most recently, the host and producer of the podcast series The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling, which dissects the backlash against Rowling for her works and political views from both the Christian right and progressive left. Megan has also hosted the anthology series The Essential Sam Harris on the Making Sense podcast.
Her perspectives in all this work are informed by her upbringing in the Westboro Baptist Church. Megan is the granddaughter of Fred Phelps, founder of the church. If you need a refresher, the Westboro Baptist Church is widely considered a hate group. They're a small church with a loud voice, known especially for their homophobia.
They've also protested at the funerals of soldiers and of Sandy Hook victims. And they've said a lot of hurtful things about a wide array of groups, from Jews to Muslims to transgender people. Megan's book is about the difficult and life-altering journey she embarked on when she left the church and discovered a more compassionate and less judgmental worldview. Our conversation today is broad-ranging and philosophical as we dig into the question of how you find your way again when you've been utterly lost in an ideology.
But I also wonder if part of this played into it, because like I remember when I first got out of prison and I was still sort of battling this false perception of me in the world, like one of the things that I also felt, that I wonder if you felt a similar thing, is when all of those things that you've relied on and the story that you've sort of, that's been your guiding principle throughout your life, has just disappeared or evaporated, like, do you even belong to people anymore? And if you don't belong to people, or at least the people that you thought you belonged to, who do you belong to and how do you find them? After that sort of stability that you had relied on in your entire life evaporated, where did you even look for any kind of stability?
Literally anywhere I could find it. I mean, it's really interesting looking back when you say, who do I belong to? Do I belong to anybody at all? I mean, that was absolutely a feeling that I had. And because we had spent my whole life demonizing everybody outside of the church, I had no sense of even hope, really, or not much of one, that I could ever find anyone. And I certainly didn't feel like you know, I remember I left the church with my younger sister. That actually was a really important thing to have. So I didn't feel, I mean, it's so funny. Like, I'm sorry, I haven't talked about this particularly in a long time. The fact that I had my sister at first was a really important thing. She said, "Where do we go?" And I said, I have no idea. And it ended with me saying, "We'll have to try to find some other people." And she said, "I don't want other people." Mm. And I said, "I don't want other people either." But I didn't see another choice, you know? Mm. And so it just became this thing where any tiny thread of connection that we had to any other person became a lifeline. And the first one came from a cousin of mine who had left 3.5 years earlier. And so I spent the first few weeks after I left the church with her. And then shortly after that, my sister and I felt like, oh my God, we are still so close to the church. We're still spending all this time in our hometown and running into our family in all these places. And they are acting like we don't exist. They are pretending like they don't even see us. And that was incredibly painful. And so we ran away to Deadwood, South Dakota, which I had no connection to Deadwood, except that my older brother had mentioned loving the television show. And it was a 12-hour drive away. And I was like, okay, that's as far as we can get in a day's drive. And so we'll go there. And then it was run by this couple. There were no other guests there when we arrived. And I basically just like, they're finding me around the house, like crying at various points and asking what's going on. And so I literally just start like dumping everything on this couple who turned out to be Jehovah's Witnesses, who actually share some significant part of their ideology and practices with Westboro. It's so funny now to think back. So it was like random people that I was meeting literally just like on the street or in line at a coffee shop. And then it was other people who had left the church. And then it was other people that we had targeted while we were at the church. So the enemy, quote unquote, like they are the ones who ultimately became, again, these lifelines, like helping us see other ways of perceiving the world and other ways of living in the world. It's hard to describe the level of control at Westboro because, you know, I was almost 27 when I left and I lived at home. My mom knew where I was and what I was doing at all times. Like I joked for a long time about how I still got excited to go to the grocery store without permission. And so it's like I had no control over any of the, not even the minor decisions in my life, really. And so when I left, it was like decision-making was this muscle that had atrophied. And so I just had no idea where to go or what to do. And so, yeah, that whole first year after I left the church, I was just like pulling on any thread, any connection I had to any other person and sort of floating around North America, trying to find any sense of a path forward. And it was really hard and it was really challenging. But I was also really lucky that, first of all, just that I'm in general just a very open person. And so I was able to connect with people and learn a lot from other people and their experiences. But also, and more important than anything else, was the fact that I received an enormous amount of grace from people who understood that I had been raised in this environment and that I had thought that I was doing good. And that didn't mean that they like excused everything that I did or anything like that, but they did understand and it made them willing to give me a second chance. And that was huge.
You know, a lot of what you're talking about sounds like a lot of people's experience leaving prison. Like when you talked about not having choices and like even the most minimal choice of going to the grocery store without permission. Like I remember one of the things that really struck me when I first got out was how amazing doorknobs were, because I had just spent 4 years of my life never actually opening a door for myself.
Wow.
It was always a guard who had a key that opened the door, or just like the refrigerator full of food and having the option of choosing all these different kinds of foods was just super overwhelming. And you're right. Like one of the things that really makes the difference in a person's life is whether or not they're willing to take the chance to open themselves up to connection, because that might be the difference between becoming totally isolated because you don't know how to connect with people after you've been through an extreme experience like the one that you went through or the one that anybody who's been in prison has went through. Or if you just take a risk and put yourself out there knowing that people are predisposed to have thoughts about you given mm-hmm. where you're coming from.
It's so interesting to hear you say that. I actually did at the time. I remember what the character in The Shawshank Redemption, Brooks, the older guy who was like terrified to leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if you remember that, but it was a really, God, that was so sad. I never like seriously contemplated suicide, but I did recognize that what I was going through was the kind of thing that would cause many people to consider that. It was like a fear in the back of my mind that I was running away from,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so like anything to avoid that kind of outcome. The thing is, I knew people who left before I left, and I know people who left after I left. And I have seen the trajectory of some of these lives. And I was just trying to be, again, very aware, like that, the instinct to go inward. Like I did consider for a little while, should I just like change my name? Should I try to move on as if I didn't live this whole life before? You know, the appeal to kind of trying to run away from it
mm-hmm.
was very strong. And I'll say again, like, I mean, if I hadn't met people pretty quickly, including, I mention a lot, this wonderful man, David Abbotball, who ran a blog called Julicious, and he was one of the people who helped me see outside of Westboro's paradigm. He was one of the people I was talking to on Twitter who was able to find these inconsistencies in Westboro's theology that persuaded me and changed my mind. But while that was an enormous, important thing that he did, I would say that what he did after I left was equally so, because he was the person who said, you can't hide from this, or you could try, but you shouldn't. You know, he taught me about this concept in Judaism called tikkun olam, which means to repair the world. And it's this idea that we all have kind of an obligation to see the brokenness in the world and to do what we can to try to repair it. And he said, you know, you and your family have added to that brokenness. And he wasn't trying to, it was never in like an angry, judgy way. It was just like kind of a very matter of fact. And I totally saw and understood that as well. Mm. And he was the one who invited me to the Julicious Festival in Long Beach, California. And, you know, this event that I had protested a couple of times before, including just these incredibly contentious, hostile, acrimonious protests where we were surrounded and, you know, people were hitting my family and me and yelling and screaming and saying all kinds of really horrible things. The police, like, were looking on and encouraging and laughing at the whole scene. And to be invited there, it was a terrifying thing, I mean, to even contemplate going to those people. And essentially, you know, casting myself on the mercy of the court, if you will, you know, like, and knowing how hostile it had been in that, not stranger, like it was the same environment, you know, and the grace, again, that David showed my sister and me, his willingness to be associated with us, I think was such a, it was a real moment of flux, and his willingness to do that and to help us find ways of repairing some of the damage that we cause, to even feel like we could. You know, we come from this environment. You know, we had a website and a matching picket sign, theworldisdoomed.com. Like, we literally thought there was no hope in the world. And so now to have David saying, yes, there is hope, and yes, you can do something, and specifically, you can do something, you know? And it was, if that hadn't happened very soon, I think, after I left, I think maybe I would have gone the route of isolation and running away and hiding.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. I'm curious about your belief during this whole phase and how much your separation in a social sense from your family and community how abrupt that was and how much that mirrored or didn't mirror the abruptness of your belief transition out of the things that you believed when you were a part of that community.
It was so bound up together that, and it is like day and night, right? When you leave Westboro, as soon as you tell them that you are leaving, or usually people don't actually tell, they just disappear. But I mean, like I left on a Sunday afternoon, evening, and went back the next day to get the rest of my things. And I rang the doorbell of the home that I had lived in since the day I was born. And it is this immediate, like you are inside and then you are outside and there is no in between. And I would say, like, because of how intertwined my beliefs were with the idea that Westboro's understanding of the Bible was the only true, you know, interpretation of it. By the time I left, because there was a period of about 4 months when I first truly started to question Westboro's doctrines, I no longer believed that, but I had started to spend a lot of time trying to, like, examining other interpretations of the Bible, and for the first time, really considering that they might be right, rather than explicitly setting out to try to prove them wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But there were just like several specific things in the Bible that had always kind of in the back of my mind troubled me in a way, or things that made me uneasy, but I couldn't quite put my finger on why until I did finally truly accept the idea that we could be wrong. And so when all of those questions and doubts started to kind of come into my conscious mind for the first time, rather than just that like feeling of uneasiness, I couldn't stop them. Hmm. And so all of the questions about like, how do we know that the Bible is the Word of God? Why the King James Version and not, you know, all these other ones that we've spent all this time demonizing? There are a lot of things in the Bible that I think are really good and really valuable, but there are also things that I have never found a good explanation for. Or how they could possibly be interpreted in a way that, yeah, I still do ask Christians about some of these things because I'm interested in how they have come to terms with them. And so to actually answer your question in the short version, they were so tied together that when I left, I basically come to see the Bible as just another book. There are things in books that I love and that I quote and that have become part of my sense of the world and how it works and how I want to be in the world. Some of those things absolutely come from the Bible, but I neither accept the bad because of the good nor reject the good because of the bad.
Hey, listeners, thanks for tuning in. This podcast can only exist thanks to listener support. So please consider becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/KnoxRobinson.
What about yourself? Like, how did your faith in your ability to understand the world, was that shaken? Did you at any point like...
Sorry. Yes.
Please elaborate.
I'm sorry. I was just like flashing back to like, I'm it's so hard to like describe the sense that like of being completely lost, and that because I think some people could leave that environment and think, well, they were wrong, I'm gonna go find something that's right. But for me, it was much deeper than that, because it was like my whole life I believed this was right, and I can still quote you all the chapters and verses in the Bible that explain why all the things that we did according to this belief system, why this is right. But I also knew, again, my family, they are, I talk a lot about this in The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling, like the whole end of the series is about this question of discernment. How do you know if you're right? How do you know if you're wrong? Because in the environment in which I grew up, I was surrounded by people who are intelligent, analytical, logical, well-educated, really dedicated to the idea of doing good and of their willingness to dedicate all of their time and energy and resources. And knowing all of that, and that at the end of the day, we still had come to this position that I eventually came to see as wrong and destructive and harmful in the world, it's really terrifying. Because if all of those things can be true and you still end up in this really ugly place, what leg do I have to stand on?
Yeah. And not even just like slightly wrong, but like very, profoundly, very wrong. Yeah.
Yes, profoundly wrong. And it was actually one of the really interesting things, you know, in the last episode of the series, we open with this conversation that I had with Stacey Schiff, who is this amazing Pulitzer Prize winning biographer who wrote a book about the Salem witch trials that came out several years ago. And as she's describing the fact that the people who prosecuted those, you know, the judges in those witch trials, they were among the smartest, most well-educated members of the community, some of them at Harvard. And the way that she put it was something like the idea that you can put all of your intellect, that you can scour your soul, you can ask all of the authorities for their help and still make this kind of colossal error where you have 19 people hanged on the basis of what we now see as this delusion. Like, that is a terrifying thing to realize about what it means to be human. And I absolutely experienced that when I left Westboro.
Yeah. It's really nice to talk to someone who's come at that realization about just how incredibly wrong even the most well-intentioned, thoughtful people can be from a different angle. Because like for the wrongfully convicted community, it's like, okay, you're an innocent person who's being accused of something you didn't do. And it's, you know, for a fact that you didn't do it. And yet you're facing, you know, life in prison. There's just a fracture between you and the rest of humanity that you can never forget. And it's really,
because they think it's so easy. Like, oh, it should be just so easy, so clear to know what is right and what is wrong. Isn't it obvious? Like, don't you see?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and the prosecutors especially, like they all believe they're doing the right thing. They're trying to bring closure to the families of victims. They're trying to
And they're willing to like torture
society.
People to do it. And,
you know,
like,
they don't think of themselves as doing something bad. Not a single one of them does. Mm-hmm. Even the cops and the prosecutors who break rules and plant evidence, I would wager they're doing that because they believe that this person is a bad person who needs to go away. And that if we can't get him for this crime, he did some other crime.
Mm-hmm. They're protecting people.
Yeah.
They're not, yeah.
They think of themselves that way, yeah.
Yeah. The last episode of our series is, it's called What If You're Wrong? Because that question, I don't know if to say it haunts me, but it absolutely preoccupies me. Mm. Because I think, again, people think it should be very clear and obvious. And, you know, some people don't like that question. Some people think like that we're arguing, well, you can never know anything for certain. And so therefore you never adopt any positions or you never feel strongly about anything. And you just kind of are a wishy-washy person or whatever. Like that's kind of the image I think that people get. And I don't think that's the case. Mm-hmm. I really love that phrase, strong opinions loosely held. It's more about like maintaining the knowledge that no matter how much you know, you are a human being, and there is a massive amount of information and experience outside of what you have been able to assimilate into your life and your understanding. And your willingness to be open to that information and to be willing to be changed by that information, so much of your willingness to do that relies on the idea that you are willing to not conflate your beliefs with yourself, right? And so it's like, if you can change your mind without feeling like you are betraying yourself, it's something that is, I think, is really important. And it's not obvious to a lot of people why we should be able to maintain some kind of separation there, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And that actually takes me back to another thing that I wanted to sit with for a second, which is this Julicious blogger who basically said, like, obviously, I don't believe in the ideology that you have dedicated your life to in the past, but I believe in you as a person, and I'm willing to stand by you as a person, even in the face of that being controversial. And how that's the sort of positive flip side of that realization, that people aren't their ideologies. They are people, and there's more to them even than their ideologies, and there is a chance for growth. Like the idea that like the person who is capable of harm is also capable of great healing towards others is something that I think that we don't often see. And the big ideology of a lot of people is this idea that there are good people and there are bad people and there's nothing in between, and you identify the good people and the bad people by their ideology. And the idea that like somebody who has a different ideology than you, that even may have caused you harm, is capable of good and capable of healing is a really, really, I think, wise and also scary thing for a lot of people, because it does involve the question of like trust and risk, and how do you associate with somebody who's proven themselves to be harmful? Like, can you talk to me more about, first of all, what that gesture looked like and felt like for you, and how did you interpret not only what he was doing, but like, how did that help you interpret yourself as a human being?
Oh, so that's a great question, first of all. And when you ask, like, what did it look like? I immediately flash back to standing outside of this rabbi's house in Los Angeles. So when David invited me and my sister to that festival, we got there a few days early, and we were supposed to stay in the home of like one of the festival's volunteers. And I knock on this door and David answers. And this is the second time I've seen him. The last time I'd seen him was on the picket line, where we are on opposite sides and surrounded by all these like people, some of whom are being violent. And now he's inviting me into this house. Mm. And the rabbi's house is such that like when you walk in, like it's, you're right in the middle of the dining room, which is like festival headquarters at this point. So there's all these, you know, people sitting around their dining room table, and everybody is just staring at me kind of wide-eyed, and like nobody's making any sudden movements. So it's just like very awkward. And David is just acting like this is the most normal thing in the world. He's greeting me like an old friend. He's grabbing my bag. He gives me a hug. You know, and I know this. I mean, I felt it at the time, but I mean, I really appreciate it even more now. You know, he was going out on a limb for me. Mm. And the rabbi and his wife are sitting there, and pretty quickly, as we have this greeting, David's chattering away and acting like this is all perfectly normal, and it's late because my flight got in late, and the rabbi and his wife kind of look at each other almost like out of the corner of their eye and kind of nod a little bit, and they're like, "She can stay." And so like now I'm like going to be sleeping on the couch of this rabbi. Like we had literally held a sign at those protests that said, "Your rabbi is a whore." And like, this is one of those rabbis. And the fact that, you know, that was just a wild thing in the moment. And just, again, just full of grace. Like they were taking a risk. I think it's hard for people to understand, like, and David has talked to me about this since then. They really thought, not just that we were out there protesting, but that we meant them harm in some very real sense. And they had 4 children in that house. The youngest was 5, and I got woken up the next morning by the 5-year-old wearing like one of those Mickey Mouse sorcerer's hats, like patting me on the head and singing. It was just like, again, it's like, it's amazing to me how quickly they were willing to give me a second chance. And it's really funny. There's this quote. It is the epigraph of my book, and it is something that really informs my life and how I think about people. It's this line from The Great Gatsby: "Reserving judgments is a matter of infinite hope." Hmm. And to me, that is the encapsulation of the idea of grace and the willingness to see other people as being on a journey, and who they are in this moment, whether that's good or bad, like this is not the end of their journey. And you can contribute to their lives and their processes, like the things that make them what they are, and that can have a really positive effect on them. In other words, it is that hopefulness, and it's absolutely something that I feel a lot. There was one other thing, a couple of other things that David said and did in those very early days that I think had a huge effect on me. One of them was in an interview that we did together, he told the reporter, he said, "My revelation this week, after spending all this time with Megan and her sister, is that they're wonderful guests. They're helping with the dishes. They're like contributing in all these different ways. And that's wonderful. And I can see that their parents raised good kids. Like they must have had good parents. And mm-hmm. when I think and I hear them talk about their family, it makes me realize that if I had been raised in that environment, I would have been out there doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. I would have been exactly what they were, what they became. And I don't know if when I was faced with a decision that they faced, that I would have had the strength to walk away from that in the way that they have. So that was a really, just again, very graceful moment, like for him to set aside the fact that we had said all these and done all these horrible things to him in particular. He was one of the first people that I had attacked after I joined Twitter, and that he was willing to think about and to empathize with me. That was an incredibly powerful thing. And then the other thing, sorry, this is a very long answer. Mm. I really love David, in case you...
Obviously no, but this is great. Like, it's one thing to have, like, the idea, oh, I'm going to give good input into the life of a person who's growing and changing. And it's another thing to say, this is what it exactly looks like. So mm-hmm. I am all about, like, tell me these details.
Yeah, okay, good. Sorry. one of the other, like, really pivotal moments for me was when we were sitting at the Shabbat table at the rabbi's house that same week, and my sister and I were both crying, and we, you know, felt like we had betrayed our family and the only people who had ever loved us and everything that we had stood for. And David, just again, in this very, he's just so, I think naturally, it seems to me, like full of empathy, he said, "You are your parents' children." And I was like, "How can you say that? We have completely betrayed them, and now we have lost them forever." And he said, "They're the ones." He said, "In a way, leaving Westboro Baptist Church was the most Westboro Baptist Church thing you could have done, because they're the ones who taught you to stand up for what you believe in, no matter what it cost you. They just never imagined that you would be standing up to them."
Hmm. Wow.
And like that realization that, sorry, the realization that we could walk away from that and not lose everything that we were and everyone that we loved, like that we could still honor them in a way, that we could hold on to some really important parts of our upbringing, was an incredibly powerful moment. And I think really important to not feel like these two parts of our lives, the before and the after, were completely unbridgeable.
Mm. Yeah.
The way you talk about grace is really powerful with this experience. And I think the idea of risks and rewards with grace is interesting, especially in relation to its inverse with judgment and with condemnation, right? It's easy to see, I think, for most people, how being vulnerable in the way that these people were to you, showing that grace, it opens them up to harm, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a risk of grace. But I think people don't as easily see the risk of judgment, the risk of condemnation, because it feels like a way to keep yourself safe from other people, to push away the people who might harm you, to put them in a box or cast them out in some way. But of course, the risk is to yourself when you engage in that kind of excommunication, right? You've been on both sides of that. The risk to self from engaging in that kind of judgment, and the reward to self from engaging in grace. Like, how do you think now about what the sort of personal risks and rewards are of those two different modes of being in the world?
I think you're right in that the risks of grace are obvious and the benefits of grace are not obvious. And I think the, like as you said, the inverse is true of judgment. It makes you feel good in a lot of ways. Like, mm-hmm. you know, again, I'm coming from, my family was incredibly judgmental and we thought that it was a good thing. We are protecting ourselves from, not just from bad people, but from sin that will lead us astray. And so we are protecting ourselves and we are showing our own righteousness by pointing out the unrighteousness of others. And so there is a certain level of that sense of righteousness and of you are doing a moral good in the world by doing that. And I think for me, coming from that place of essentially judging everyone all the time, and just to give you an example of like what that looks like, after I left, I felt like I was seeing the world in split screen. So like I was seeing the world as I had at Westboro, like kind of judging a woman for like if I can see that her hair has been cut or if she's wearing makeup or she's wearing earrings, like all these things that were forbidden for me and for the people in my church, the women specifically in my church. And that's one side of my brain. And the other side of my brain thinking, like, why did we do that? like, what did the fact that this woman cut her hair? I mean, like, I know, like, there or whatever all the Bible verses, but like, suddenly the idea of judging somebody on that basis seems like insane. Like, why? Like, is there not space in the world for different ways of thinking about your hair or whatever? And it seems silly. But also, it's been one of the things that, to me, that has happened over the past decade, watching the culture at large adopt that judgmental attitude and very hard lines about a lot of things. And, you know, even hair, like, I'm sorry, this is just like the thing that just popped into my head, you know, this Seattle coffee shop owner who was wearing dreads and had for a very long time and issued this public apology for the microaggression or cultural appropriation of wearing her hair in dreads. It's just like one tiny example of this broader thing where like people think that judging others is, that it is the way, right? And to my mind, one of the things that was so amazing after I left the church was having taken that to such an extreme, the benefits of not doing it suddenly became incredibly clear and wonderful and liberating and beautiful, right? The idea that like I could be in relationship with people who thought differently than I did, who believed differently than I did, who lived differently than I did, how my life was so enriched by that. Mm. And from learning about the perspectives of other people, of not needing to judge everyone, the moment I encountered a place where our thoughts about something diverged, even when they diverged in like major important ways, I still learned things from their perspective. And that was so amazing and so valuable. And there was this Bible verse that my mom, you know, one of many that my mom would quote all the time. And it goes like this: can two walk together except they be agreed? And that at the church, the answer was very obvious. Like, of course not. Of course you can't be in relationship with people unless you are agreed on these, you know, all these important issues. And it was really funny because it was a rhetorical question where the answer was immediately obvious. And then after I left and started developing relationships with people who thought differently than I did, who believed differently, I mean, and like starting with, you know, this couple who ran the inn in Deadwood, and they were Jehovah's Witnesses and, you know, had all of these beliefs that I had very recently rejected. And so like the idea that we could be friends, that they're nerds like me and even more so, and they like to read like me and they're writers and all these things, like it's... And I remember like suddenly remembering that verse at a certain point: can two walk together except they be agreed? And the rhetorical question suddenly had the exact opposite intuitive response, right? Mm. Of course you can. Like, well, we're proving it right now. Like, here we are having these completely different worldviews and able to maintain this like really wonderful relationship. Anyway, sorry, this is a very long answer again, but like it's the freedom. There is such a level of freedom in that, both freedom to have your world and your life enriched by people who think differently than you do. And then also just, I can't tell you what a burden is relieved by not thinking that you have to judge everyone's every action all the time. Like, that takes up an incredible amount of brain space. And I didn't even realize for, you know, months after I left Westboro, and suddenly I flash back to one of these meetings where somebody is being, I mean, an analog would be like somebody's being dragged on Twitter, right? Except it's now in this environment where the opinions of the people in the church are, they matter enormously. And not having that in my life on a regular basis, I was so relieved and so happy to not be part of that anymore and to be in a world and in a society where that wasn't the norm. Mm-hmm. And so it's been very sad for me over the last decade to kind of see a lot more of those puritanical impulses become more mainstream now.
You know, I wasn't expecting to do this, but in an attempt to play devil's advocate for the more puritanical,
for the
idea that, like, it's so difficult to walk hand in hand with someone and know how and when to draw a line in the sand when something matters. And I feel like mm-hmm. there's this impulse to draw lines in the sand and say it's my way or the highway as a way of showing care, and how that, of course, can get distorted and turned into a sort of everyone going down this whirlpool of not caring. But like the impulse to begin to draw lines as a impulse of care, how do you interpret that impulse? And is that the impulse that is driving people today, do you think? Or has that been corrupted in some way?
I guess I should say, first of all, like I'm not saying when I talk about how amazing it is to be in relationship with people who think differently, I'm not saying like that there is never a time that you draw that line in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe that those lines exist. I just think both at Westboro and it has become more common now to draw them on the basis of just drawing them very narrowly. So I think that different people have different levels and ability to tolerate disagreement, especially when they feel like fundamental issues. So I never do advocate, let's say, like everybody should be doing this. Not everybody has the time or the attention or the emotional wherewithal to do those things. And I don't judge people who can't or won't or who don't see the value in it. When I talk about it, it's just a way of saying there is another way. There is an alternative, because it seems like often the alternative that I'm describing is seen as itself a betrayal of some kind, inherently a betrayal of our values to listen to people who are saying things that we vehemently disagree with and that we strenuously, like we very much believe that these ideas are not good and in fact could be harming people or maybe are harming people.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying this from a position of judgment or even just like a totally rose-colored view of the world. It's just that I think either of these extremes, like you can be too permissive, but I think at this moment, it seems to be like more in the other direction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't think it's too permissive. I think it's incredibly tempting to judge and condemn people. That kind of black and white thinking, it's a very comfortable place to be in because it...
Well, you know who the bad guys are and it's not you.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, I feel like I'm just kind of sometimes trying to put my thumb on the scale on the other side of that to be like, there is hope for people to change. And the thing is, sometimes you're the one who needs to change.
Yeah.
And that can be a very hard thing
to
really consider. This is also, again, why I lean so much into that question of discernment and just the inherent difficulty of knowing for sure what is good, what is righteous. Like, think, if you just think back to any point in history, there are moments where the majority of people are convinced that slavery is right. And you can find these moments throughout history. And the question is, like, are we now past that?
Yeah. Did we finally get it all exactly right?
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. It's like, what are the beliefs that we have now that in 100 years or less, people will come to think, like, oh my God, how did they think that was the right way to behave? And it's just kind of, you know, trying to maintain that awareness in your day-to-day life.
Yeah, I mean, well, people on the forefront of movements to change society sincerely believe that they are a step ahead of the curve, right? That that I'm with those people in the future who are judging the past. And this comes down to that question of, how do you know? And I think you probably have some interesting insight into the nature of cognitive dissonance here. I think it's really hard to see the architecture of your own cognitive dissonance when you're in it. And when you come out of it, you can kind of see the shape of, what does it feel like to have contradictory values without realizing it? And I'm thinking of this, even just like the biblical, you know, judge not lest ye be judged, the whole, like, he who is without sin cast the first stone. Like, those ideas of anti-judgment seem from, you know, I wasn't as deeply embedded in any Christian culture as you, but they seem pretty prominent in that worldview. And yet it resulted in a highly judgmental, in the Westboro version, a highly judgmental lifestyle. How do those two things square?
So it's really interesting, because when you say judge not lest ye be judged, we had answers for all of these things. I started protesting when I was 5. That was when, you know, the Westboro's picketing ministry, as they call it, began. And so standing on the street and engaging with people all the time and answering these questions, like, these were, they came up all the time. And so the judge not lest ye be judged is part of this verse that continues, that basically says, because with whatever judgment you judge, you will be judged by that judgment. And so you essentially better be judging by God's standard. So it doesn't mean that you'd never judge, because there's other passages. For instance, judge not according to the appearance, but judge righteous judgment. So if it meant you never judge, well, then that's in direct conflict with this other verse. So anyway, so there was always answers for, or apparent answers for those things. But this one didn't occur to me until after I first considered that Westboro might be wrong, like, on a more fundamental level than just one or two or three specific points of doctrine. And there were these moments that suddenly it was like they had been buried, just waiting for something to prompt me to think about them in a conscious way for the first time. And one of them made me feel absolutely insane, because my family, we saw ourselves as loving our neighbor. The passage where love thy neighbor first appears in the Bible is in the book of Leviticus. And it says, thou shalt not hate thy neighbor in thine heart, but thou shalt in any wise rebuke your neighbor and not suffer his sin upon him. Thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. So we see loving our neighbor is the opposite of hating our neighbor, right? And you hate them when you allow them to sin and you don't rebuke them. So our work was literally the embodiment of loving our neighbor. So going and telling people that they were on their way to hell, like, that was how we showed our love for our neighbor. So that's one part of our ideology. And that was such a fundamental thing to believe, that even though everybody thought we were hateful, we were actually doing a loving thing and following God's standard of love. So that was, again, like, foundational for me. And yet there came a point where we started to engage in what's called imprecatory prayer, which is praying for God to curse people. And there are examples of this in the Bible, and that's where we got it from. These examples, like, where King David is praying for his enemies' children to be fatherless and for their wives to be widows, for God to break their teeth, and, like, all of this, like, very, you know, biblical language about how God is going to execute these curses on people who don't obey him and who have set their hand against God's people, aka us. And so I remember this moment where suddenly realizing that we are both seeing ourselves as loving our neighbor and asking God to kill them, to curse their families. And I felt insane when I realized that I had very earnestly held these two beliefs that are in direct conflict with one another and had not realized it for years. And it made me think of another verse. Sorry, I'm just going to quote all the verses. I haven't talked about this in so long, but like all these verses are just like so deeply. And it basically like, he said, I could not tell that I was deceived, that I couldn't say that I had a lie in my right hand. And that's what it felt like, that I, again, very earnestly believed these two directly contradictory things. How did we get there again? I forgot what the question was.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about cognitive dissonance, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just because of the way that the human mind is organized. It's like each of these beliefs are functional, right? We're not constantly thinking necessarily in a holistic way, every single one of these things. Although, I mean, we can try to, and I know we definitely tried to, but it is amazing to realize what you can believe and, again, still be extremely wrong, illogical, unreasonable, and not realize it.
I think, like, a lot of people are afraid to embrace the humanity of people who believe different things than them. And that's part of the impulse. Like, you see this a lot, especially in the criminal justice world, where if somebody has broken the law or made a mistake, whether they did so and they went to jail or whether they did so and they're a prosecutor who continues having a career, like there's this impulse to say that's the kind of person they are and I can never trust again. And it's not on me to have hope in their humanity or to embrace the idea that they could be more than the worst thing that they've ever done. And what would you say to anyone who is afraid of, first of all, having the openness inside of themselves to consider that maybe something that they strongly believe could be wrong, but also those who still believe that they are right, but like are afraid to leave any kind of opening to someone who believes what they feel is a harmful ideology?
I think there are a lot of answers to that. I think, first of all, I would say I don't think you have to. Just as a matter of practicality, you don't have to. You don't have to be that person. I think there are a lot of reasons why you might want to be, and I can tell those to you, but it's not from a perspective of shaming or thinking that people should be forced to be hopeful. I think from a very practical perspective, like one of the reasons why we want to have a society where that is more the norm is that by not allowing people to change, to not allow space or hope for them to change, we are disincentivizing that change. I don't think we want to live in a world where people who have done bad things are incentivized to stay in those bad patterns of behavior. We want to live in a society, I think, I want to live in a society where when somebody realizes that they've done wrong, that they can turn around and choose a different path and there is space for them. And so that's one part. And the other major thing that comes to mind is, you know, sometimes people will look at my story and think, oh, well, you are the exception and not the rule. And I just really profoundly disagree with that because I think I did a very human thing. I responded in a very human way to people who treated me like I was a human being. They recognized that as a human being, I was the product of my beliefs and my upbringing and all the experiences that had led me to that place. And they understood that and were willing to engage with me and to help me see outside of this paradigm that I'd been raised in. And I think you can see it anytime you're looking at a poll about the way that public opinion has changed. So for instance, this came up on Twitter several months ago where I was making this exact point and somebody said, well, it looks like a lot of people changed their mind on, for instance, same-sex marriage. You know, there was a whole lot of people who were against it for a very long time and the level of acceptance when it comes to same-sex marriage has exploded over the past. I mean, President Obama, when he ran, was like, against same-sex marriage, had to, and that was not that long ago. And that was because of, you know, the fact that many people in this country, most people, were against it. And so, again, we want space for people to change their minds without feeling like they are going to be hated for it or shamed for the rest of their lives. Like, again, how that disincentivizes it. But even people who have changed on much more fundamental levels, or maybe you could say more profound changes, I am not the only one by any means. There are people who were neo-Nazi skinheads. There were people like Derek Black, very well-known white nationalist, son of Don Black, who created the, you know, Stormfront. Derek had a like children's page. He was the godson of David Duke, Grand Wizard, former Grand Wizard of the KKK, you know, essentially white nationalist royalty, who was persuaded to abandon that ideology because of conversations with at Shabbat dinners at his small liberal arts college in Florida. Then you also have Daryl Davis, who is a Black jazz musician who has persuaded, I think, more than 200 members of the KKK to give up their robes through these conversations. It is a very human thing, I think, to change your mind when you encounter compelling evidence. And I think the idea that we would not have hope that other people could change, or that they are irredeemable because they voted for Donald Trump, for instance. You know, the kind of very hard lines that have been drawn in a lot of ways on a lot of different issues in society over the past, again, 10 years or less. We want space for change. And I think if we write people off, it allows us to justify doing all kinds of horrible things to those people. Mm. Because in the absence of conversation, if we do not have words to persuade people, what we are left with is force and violence. And that is not a world that I want to live in. And so I guess maybe I would say to people who think that just writing people off and closing off paths to redemption, I would say consider the alternative. Because I think if we really do, the negatives of that become much more clear.
Yeah, this is back in, I don't know, a few years ago, I felt like this was distilled into the whether to punch or not to punch a Nazi question.
Yeah.
And I think when Richard Spencer got punched in the face at some protest or something, I saw a lot of people debating this. And a lot of people on the left were like, yeah, punch that motherfucker in the face. Mm-hmm. You know, that no toleration for that sort of rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
And the other side of that is, well, what results do you get from that?
Like, mm-hmm. You feel good.
It might feel good, but does it change his mind? Does it draw people to his cause, or does it push them away from his cause? Does it open minds of the people who were on the periphery of that worldview, or does it push them further into that worldview that you disagree with? And I've felt pretty strongly that punching people in the face generally doesn't make them more amenable to your worldview.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and the other side of that too is like, do you want people to punch you in the face
yeah.
when they disagree with your worldview and think that your views are dangerous? Because there's also just this lack of understanding that eventually, in general, I think, the tools that you are willing to wield against other people will be used against you.
Mm.
It's literally the golden rule. Like, not to be too overly reductive here, but it is, I mean, I think just very short-sighted to think that if you justify those things, the same thing will be justified against you. And again, to my mind, it's no contest. I think not only is it just not the world that we want to live in, it's not the way that we want to be treated, it's also just not effective. It's not an effective way of changing hearts and minds and creating the world that you want to exist.
If you looked at our society today as an individual for a moment, where do you think we are in this journey of ideology? Is the nation in the grip of an ideology, or is there some cognitive dissonance at play here? What direction are we moving, you know?
Oh, this is such a, I feel like I'm not so good at this. I'm much more like, for instance, micro versus macro economics is what I'm thinking about. But to answer your question, though, to my mind, I think we've lost our way a bit. I think we have forgotten why we have chosen as a nation some very fundamental principles. Why free speech instead of censorship? Why due process? You know, these things that are so, I think, the things that differentiate this society from societies of the past. It's like we've forgotten why we chose that path. And I think we have to rewind a bit, rewind the tape and look back and try to help people recognize how we as a society benefit today. How do we as individuals benefit today from the fact that these rights were enshrined in the Constitution? And that view, I think, of like, why not? Some people, gosh, I'm sorry, I'm getting stuck on the free speech thing because I've been thinking about it so much lately, because it's like people think that it's possible to just proactively protect ourselves from bad ideas by censoring them. And I think it doesn't connect with human nature, or the fact that people come to bad ideas in all kinds of ways. Some people come to them the way that I did, you know, taught by their families and their communities. Some people read them in books. Some people reason themselves into bad ideas. And so it's the idea of trying to just cut those things off or to make them unspeakable will suddenly stop them from being a force in the world is, I think it doesn't connect with what it is to be human, and that we have to do the hard thing and have the hard conversations, and to remember that we also are capable of going down a bad path, and that we don't want to be punched back into submission. We would want somebody to hopefully lead us back in as graceful a way, I think, as possible.
Once again, Megan Phelps Roper is the host of the podcast series The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling and author of the book Unfollow.
If you're enjoying Labyrinths, please get lost with us. Find us on Twitter, at Amanda Knox.
At Man Under Bridge.
You can learn more about our work and how to support it at knoxrobinson.com. And please leave us a 5-star review and spread the word on social media.
Labyrinths is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. This episode was written and produced by us, with theme music by Josh Budo Karp.
These aren't the ads you're looking for.
These aren't the ads we're looking for.
This podcast is listener supported.
This podcast is listener supported.
Visit patreon.com/Knox Robinson.
Come on, boys. Let's visit patreon.com/Knox Robinson.
Ha 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 ha!